Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and of course, I'm with Layla Mutin, Hoffman Center nutritionist. She has earned a master's degree in the field of nutrition, and she's also a registered dietitian. We work together daily at the Hoffman Center. You can see either of us, we both have patients individually, and we share patients who are the center's patients, working together with them, formulating diet plans and supplement plans to address complex medical problems, which we're going to be doing as part of today's Q&A. So what's next?
Yeah, this comes from Carolyn in New Orleans. Dr. Hoffman, would you discuss intracellular mineral deficiencies, how they are diagnosed and treated, please?
Okay. Well, you know, what this is about is that, you know, it makes a lot of sense to ask the question, what's happening in the cells?
Yeah.
And rather than measuring stuff in the blood. Mm-hmm. Because what we're really hooked on doing blood tests. Blood's such an available thing. You know, you stick a needle in, it's like, let me go for a blood test. So what do you find out when you do a blood test? Well, what you find out is you find out what's in the plasma of the blood, and you find out what's in the red blood cells. But this doesn't speak too much to what's happening in the tissues. So things that are prevalent in the blood, they're easy to measure. But, for example, magnesium is mostly intracellular. It's something that exists inside the cell. And so it's hard to determine intracellular magnesium with a regular blood test. Well, I guess you can get the red blood cells and you can break them down and see what's in the red blood cells, but they're not like really what's happening deep inside the tissue. Mm-hmm. So, similarly, we can measure what's floating around in terms of thyroid hormone, but we don't really know what's happening deep within the tissue in the body. So this is kind of a dilemma. One of the ways that they have attempted to measure intracellular minerals is through a cheek swab. This is a test where you do a little scraping of the tissue inside the cheek, and then you send it to a lab and they measure what's going on there. That test isn't even available in the state of New York. In many other states, it's available.
Okay.
She's in
Louisiana, so.
Yeah, I guess that's a test that might be available, and that's maybe why she's asking. Maybe your doctor has asked her to do an intracellular test. I got to say though, what's happening in a cheek, in the superficial skin on in the mouth, may or may not mirror what's happening in tissue deep within the body. So
that's true.
I think this is a really big deal. Another way of saying this is people say, well, do I have adequate calcium? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, how do you find out? Well, you can do a blood test, and mostly you'll find adequate calcium. But where you're concerned is where the calcium belongs, is in the bone. So you have to look at the bone to determine if you have adequate calcium. And that requires imaging techniques that pick up on the calcium content of the bone and whether the bone is osteoporotic or not.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what else to say about that. And she's saying, what's the... What additional implication is that? Is that a good test? Or
that's all. That's all she says. Just that you would discuss that, how it's diagnosed.
Okay.
And
so, diagnosed, treated. So, another way to get at that is, when we look at toxic things, we may look at toenail levels of things. Actually, one of the ways a good way to determine if people have adequate selenium is with toenail selenium. Because the selenium accumulates in the toenails. Then there's hair analysis, but that's been fraught with problems because the composition of hair is not like the composition of ordinary tissue.
Yeah.
So if you say, there's a lot of too much potassium in the hair or too much sodium or, there's not really...
And what if there are confounders like using, hair colors and things that are very toxic anyway?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and the hair is exposed to a lot of also environmental toxins. So, say you get a blast from a construction site, and you might put a trace amount of lead or cadmium into your hair. Does that mean that your body internally is riddled with that? And that may not be the case. So,
that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a problem in the field of testing for nutrients. Is we may be measuring the wrong thing. We may be measuring blood, and so,
right. Okay. All right. Thank you for your question, Carolyn. And this comes from Bob. who apparently is able to run 9 miles. Dr. Hoffman, after a 9-mile run...
And he's 86 years old. That's all the more remarkable.
Oh, okay.
No,
okay.
Does he stay...
After a 9-mile run and perspiring heavily, what nutrients need to be replaced? Well, first of all, Bob, electrolytes. You want to get rehydrated.
Right.
And getting your electrolytes back would be a good idea, which includes sodium, potassium, magnesium, calcium, all of that.
Right.
And what would you say? For a good repair, I think after a 9-mile run, which is a long time running, to repair your muscles with maybe a whey protein.
Yep, absolutely. Because
or something.
That's,
I mean, if you're not immediately going to dinner and having a good protein meal, I would do a whey protein smoothie or something like that.
You know, it's very important when training at a very high level, and I've done this, that your body is undergoing, constant real hammering. And it's very important to eat within a certain period of time after the exercise to replenish the glycogen that you lose in your muscle and also to help provide the amino acids that are necessary for muscle repair. So whey protein would be ideal for that. It's relatively low in carbohydrates. It's not a big sugary thing. It's not like Gatorade. Although, Gatorade has some advantages. It has electrolytes, but it also has a lot of other junk, coloring, and probably too much sugar.
Yeah.
But I tell you, I will say this, is athletes at a very high level of endurance, they need to take in something really sugary. You know, when I was doing the marathon and I passed the station where you had a choice of water or Coca-Cola or Gatorade, I would invariably take the Gatorade or the Coca-Cola after 20-some miles of running. You really bonk. You run out of carbohydrates. This is not an ordinary exertion. This is a very, very high level of exertion, and there are not that many individuals who can sustain that for literally hours and not require some carbohydrates to put back into their muscles as glycogen. So, but, look, 9 miles, if you're well-trained, I don't think you need to take tons of sugar to do that. I would just eat. I would eat a balanced meal. Maybe take, what I used to do is I would sometimes be so hungry after a really long workout that I would come home, I would take a whey shake, and then I would, in a more deliberate way, gradually prepare a meal. It might take, a half an hour or so, and then eat a little bit after that, a balanced actual meal. But, the temptation is, you come in from a run, how quickly are you going to be able to prepare a meal from scratch if it's a good meal?
Right. You have to prepare it before the run.
You do. In effect, you do. Yeah.
And you have to prepare it and then just reheat.
Plus, you may feel so tired that you don't really feel like standing around. You just want to take, just take a load off and, cross your legs and, read a magazine and take a whey shake and, rehydrate.
Yeah.
So, that's a good way to go. Look, specific nutrients. Okay, what are we, some people believe that, carnitine is the magical ingredient or coenzyme Q. And, there's frankly not that much evidence that those things increase athletic performance. I think that after exertion, it might be a good idea to take higher doses of vitamin E as an antioxidant because there's some free radical production.
That's right, more free radicals from that kind of exertion, the antioxidants. What do you think of creatine for this, too?
I don't think creatine does a heck of a lot for the aerobic athlete. I haven't found it that helpful. I did have one of my best times in the triathlon after taking beet juice for daily for several days before an event. And it's,
to get your glycogen stores.
It wasn't so much that. It actually builds up nitric oxide, which enhances circulation and may fuel athletic performance. There are several beet formulas that are considered, nitric oxide enhancers. I guess you could just say, why don't you just take a Viagra before a run? That would increase nitric oxide. But then you might faint. you might pass out. You might see blue, or you might chase the first female runner that you see. I don't know what that would do. That it doesn't sound like a good idea. Don't try that.
What would you think of D-ribose for Bob?
D-ribose. I have to say that I mostly use that for serious mitochondrial problems. People who have real serious chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia problems. I tried that also. I tried everything, you know, in my athletic career. And I put it in the water bottle while I was cycling. I'm not sure that it made a big difference, you know, okay, as an energy enhancer for the cells. It's one of those things that could help, but I wasn't convinced that it made a difference.
Mm. Okay. All right, Bob, keep on keeping on.
Yeah.
9 Mile Bob.
Yeah.
That's great.
He doesn't specify his age, right?
No.
Okay.
No, not on this one. Although I think he's written us before about other things, so
okay,
kind of looks familiar. This next comes from Sherry. She says, I'm a listener of your radio show. You are great. I have a problem with palpitations. I have them after I eat, starting around 11 or 11:30 a.m. until I fall asleep.
Hmm.
I had an echocardiogram.
Wait.
Blood test.
So, excuse me. It starts in the morning and then it lasts all through the day to tonight.
She eats around mid-morning.
Okay. So,
and stays with her until she falls asleep.
Okay.
She's had an echo. She's met with the heart. She's had all the tests, cardiologist. Everything is completely normal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking magnesium and cod liver oil and tons of other vitamins. Nothing helps. It is so annoying. I am a very young 58-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other supplements that I can take to help the palpitations? I have a clue here.
Sure.
Palpitations are often a sign of food allergy.
Right.
These palpitations are starting sometime after she eats.
Mm-hmm.
That might be my first suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. There was a guy, an allergist, who, he's a little before my time, in the 60s and 70s, he wrote about what's called, his name was Coca, C-O-C-A,
uh-huh,
and he wrote about something called the Coca pulse test. And the idea was that you would take, you know, get all the different foods that you ate and, you know, have individual tastings of the food, and you would measure your pulse before and you measure your pulse after. And his belief was that there was an autonomic response of your autonomic nervous system, like a little bit of a shock to the system when you had an allergic reaction, and that mm-hmm, you could determine that the pulse would race with certain foods. So in a way, that this may be the case with her, and I agree that there may be a hidden food allergy that may be, or not precisely an allergy, but an intolerance of some kind where food is an issue. Now, the other thing is, you know, she's fine until she eats, right?
She's fine until after she eats.
Right. So it could also be a reactive hypoglycemia, you know, where
that's
she eats and then, you know, what
we... she's not telling us what she eats, so that's
right,
a question mark.
Right,
but,
right. Well, yeah, you know, we see often patients coming to our office for the glucose tolerance test. Then they've been instructed to fast overnight. And they come in and their blood sugar is like, you know, 80 or 85, normal blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And after eating, or the synthetic meal, which in this case is a sugar challenge, this is taking in very high calories. Hours later, their blood sugar may be 55. It'll go down 30 points after, in effect, eating. Or
yes,
our surrogate meal is actually kind of artificial. It's a sugar challenge.
Yeah.
But if she's eating a high carby meal, she may set herself off on a daily basis.
That's true. That's true. So Sherry could be, you know, because the blood sugar is stable especially after a whole night's fast, and then with breakfast, is whatever she's having for breakfast is destabilizing her blood sugar,
mm-hmm,
and then causing the palpitations. Getting back to Dr. Coca, this is something I've actually done myself. I used to see Dr. Teach,
yes,
who's
sure,
an allergist here,
yeah,
in New York.
And I'm sure Dr. Teach, he's a guy who's been on the scene for a long time. He knows,
yeah,
all about classic allergy. He may have known Dr. Coca personally. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's told me at the time, I was a patient of his about 30 years ago,
mm-hmm,
to do this test. Take your pulse,
sure,
before, eat the food.
Yeah.
And he was right.
Yeah.
After I had the pizza, wow.
And there wasn't even any caffeine in the pizza, right?
Faster by 17 beats. I remember writing this down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting, but...
I think, yeah, my heart rate goes up when you just pass a pizza place. I mean, just the smell is like, oh, it's so seductive. You know, it's like, it's still, I mean, I literally haven't had pizza in like 20 years, but the smell, yeah, is so seductive.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah, another thing I would submit is, mm-hmm, when you eat, sometimes there are changes in your nervous system. And how that happens is through something called the vagus nerve. And the act of eating and swallowing and filling your stomach sometimes creates a reaction in your heart. There's a part of the stomach that's called the cardia, and that's, I guess, Latin for heart, but it's the part of the stomach that lies directly adjacent to the heart, and there's a lot of shared nerves between the stomach and the heart. And there's some people just swear that when they eat or they have indigestion or they feel their stomach, they get heart palpitations. So that's just an internal sensitivity that some people have. And it's hard to say how precisely that can be fixed. I mean, maybe frequent small meals, not big meals, to not perturb
that's
the stomach. Yeah,
wow.
It's through the vagal nerve. We know that the vagus, V-A-G-U-S, I haven't the vaguest idea what it does. No, I'm not kidding. No, what it does is it's a pacer. It paces the heart. It paces the peristalsis in the intestine. It's the biggest autonomic nerve in the body that travels directly from the brain into the viscera. And it's associated with, why when you cough, you can slow down your heart. And when you press down or Valsalva, you can slow your heart rate, the diving reflex, and so on. So there's a whole something going on there, too, sometimes with people. But that's a little harder to treat.
Yeah. Okay, Sherry, check into your breakfast, what it is you're having. Yeah, that, when our patients come in and tell me, I do better until I eat. And then it all goes downhill from there.
Right.
So, right, the suspects are food allergy, destabilization of blood sugar.
It's like being a detective. I think in a second career, I think we might make good CSI detectives. Because it's detective. It's really like, we ask a lot of questions and, what happens when you do this? What happens when you do that? And you notice any, all this, these relationships, and they sometimes come together in a pattern, and then we can offer a solution.
Yeah. Okay, best of luck to Sherry. Our next question comes from Jerry. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I'm an avid listener to Intelligent Medicine on the weekends via the internet and have called you a few times. I also subscribe to the newsletter. Thank you so much. He says, a pharmacist in a health food store recommended colloidal silver for gastrointestinal issues such as diverticulosis.
Hmm.
Could you please address what do you think of this product or how it could be used?
Mm-hmm.
Is it snake oil? Thank you for your devotion to keeping us healthy.
Okay, that's a good question, and it depends on who you ask about colloidal silver. If you ask the FDA and if you ask conventional medicine, this stuff should not be taken internally. It's dangerous. But I've seen evidence to the contrary. I don't have patients drink a lot of colloidal silver for internal problems, but I think it's my use of colloidal silver. First of all, what is colloidal silver? It's silver that's suspended in a colloidal. It's kind of dissolved into very small particles that are suspended in water, and this is actually a very ancient form of healing. Before we had antibiotics, we used a lot of silver solutions. In fact, every baby who was born in the United States, because there was a lot of gonorrhea going on, and believe it or not, every baby in the United States got silver drops put into their eyes as they passed through the birth canal because this was actually a major cause of infant blindness, as the mother would have gonorrhea, and the baby would pass through the birth canal and develop a gonorrheal infection of the eyes and go blind. So they would automatically drop silver into the, like a colloidal silver solution, into the eyes of babies, silver nitrate. And also silver has recently been repopularized as a way of coating catheters. Catheters often get infected. They have surfaces that are breeding grounds for biofilms. The bacteria hide in the biofilms. And one way to retard that is with impregnating the catheter tip with silver. Also, if you go to certain sports clothing manufacturers, they advertise antibacterial shirts and undershorts that are made with silver. They have silver threads, or they're silver impregnated. So there really is something that silver is an antibacterial. I prescribe it for superficial use on the skin, for gargling if you have a sore throat or tonsillitis. We even have a silver nasal spray. I find it helpful for external use, or actually internal use. If you swallow a little bit, it's okay. But I don't urge patients to drink a lot of silver. If you have diverticulitis, well, we have a protocol. So we have actually quite a few patients with that condition. Why don't you share what we do with those people?
Well, actually, Jerry does say diverticulosis, so I want to make the distinction.
Sure, go ahead.
Diverticulosis is not an acute condition. Many people have pockets. Oftentimes it goes unnoticed. It's fine. But if a particle gets trapped into those pockets, what can happen is inflammation or an infection, and then it's diverticulitis. That's an acute situation. And now, you know, some, if you wind up in a hospital with that, certainly you would be NTO for a couple of days, possibly on IV antibiotics. But many people who get an attack of diverticulitis, it doesn't have to be that serious, but a specific carbohydrate diet is extremely helpful for people who are suffering often with repeated bouts of diverticulitis. That's what we find.
And the theory there is the specific carbohydrate diet discourages the growth of certain pathogenic bacteria.
Yeah.
You alter the food composition, the bacteria composition change, and they're less likely to create infections in those little blind loops or pockets that herniate outside the intestinal wall. And we've actually gotten away a little bit from the theory that seeds and food particles are the culprit. We used to tell people, you know, avoid tiny seeds, you know, don't eat nuts, don't eat, you know, like raspberries that have like these little tiny pits. We thought that was causing the problem.
Tomatoes, poppy seeds. Yeah.
But it turns out, according to studies, that is not really the culprit.
That's true.
I would say it's more sugar and starch in the diet that cause bacterial proliferation. You know, we've got several patients who, and I got to tell you, when they follow the diet, they're attack-free. And we have one patient, and you know him very well. He's an attorney.
Yep.
And he is a bad boy because he's a bon vivant. He loves to eat. You know, he works hard, makes some money, goes on vacation to Europe, France. And then when he doesn't stick to the diet, he comes back ruefully, remorsefully.
Yeah.
You know,
and after a trip to a hospital.
Yeah. And
on many occasions, yeah.
And by the way, he's a guy who already had surgery, and the doctor said, I can't do anything more for you. I don't want to keep doing surgery because you won't have any intestine left. Mm-hmm. So he really had no choice. The diet really helped. Also, what we'll give patients is berberine, which, by the way, we use a lot now in treatment of type 2 diabetes. But before we recognize its effects in diabetes, it is a pretty good natural intestinal antibiotic. We might use biocidin, which is something that is a natural treatment for bacterial overgrowth in the intestine. It contains gentian and other herbs that suppress the growth of harmful bacteria. We might use probiotics. Those are some of the things we would use in that condition. But SCD, specific carbohydrate diet, same diet we use for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease.
That's right.
In these people. And you know,
pick up, Jerry, you should pick up the book Breaking the Vicious Cycle by the late Elaine Gottschall.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful book if you're interested in how to treat diverticulitis, diverticulosis. It's a good read anyway.
And whenever we have a patient call up the center, they say, well, I want a treatment for diverticulitis, and our patient screener will say, are you willing to make a change in your diet? And they say, well, no, I can't do that. We'll say, look, don't waste your money, because we're not going to be able to cure it without a pretty radical diet change. And that's why a lot of people undertake surgery, because they can't do the diet change.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to have, I mean, you have a choice, you know, surgery, which unfortunately doesn't cure the problem always, or a pretty radical diet change, which will be healthy for you anyway, because many patients, they're overweight, they'll shape up with a better diet, they'll eat cleanly, they might live years longer because they're in a healthier diet, but that's important.
Yeah, yeah. You just have to change what you put in the pie hole.
Yeah.
That's it.
Like, are we going to, maybe we can embroider that on a, like, do a little embroidery and put it on, like, a sampler in your office.
Oh, change what you put in the pie hole. Yeah.
Frame it. Okay. Well, with that thought, I think it's time to take leave of our listening audience. You may have a couple more questions. Save them for next week.
Yes.
Listeners, you've got questions, radioprogram@AOL.com. We've had several interesting questions this week, thought-provoking and good conversation starters. Make sure you subscribe to our newsletter, both Layla and I write for the newsletter. What you got in the newsletter this week?
The belly fat and dementia.
Okay. And I've got an article on poor protoplasm.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
So, you know, the article basically asks the question, do you have poor protoplasm? And if you want to find out what that means, check out drhoffman.com, subscribe to the newsletter this week, because that's our subject. And each week we also do a radio program on weekends. Tune in to your local radio station, or you can listen live via drhoffman.com. I do that program alone. Layla is busy sunning herself on the beach while I do that show, or doing something else, or relaxing at home. We've got to give you some time off on Saturday. Okay, great. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.